Today's Taisho will be on Jing Yong's Garuda, Case 44 in the Book of Serenity. Introduction. A lion strikes an elephant. A Garuda strikes a dragon. Flying and running, they still distinguish ruler and subject. A patch-robed monk should remember guest and host. But how can someone who brazenly affronts the authority of heaven be judged? Case. A monk asked Master Xingyang Hu, "A dragon king comes out of the sea, sky and earth. A dragon king comes out of the sea. Sky and earth are tranquil. How is direct presentation?" The master said, "The Garuda, king of birds, takes command of the universe. Who can stick his head out here?" The monk said, "Suppose one suddenly appears, what then?" Xingyang said, "It's like a falcon catching a pigeon. If you don't realize, check in front of the tower. Then for the first time, you'll know the real." The monk said, "If so, then I'll fold my hands on my chest and retreat 3 paces. Xingyang said, "You blind turtle under the seat of Mount Sumeru, don't wait for another scarring from a rap on the head." Verse. The imperial decree comes down, the commanding orders distinct. Within the heartland, the emperor, outside the border, the general. Without awaiting the thunder to roust the insects, how could one know the wind stops the coursing clouds? A continuous weave under the loom. Naturally, there's a gold needle and jade thread. Before the seed, the seal is wide open, emptiness. Originally, there's no writing. Thank you for coming here this morning. Something made you get up early and drive here and practice or come to hear the talk. Something. But what? I think ordinary consciousness is a bit like this. You get up in the morning and you say to yourself, "Oh, it's a little too cold in here," and you turn down the air conditioner. And then you think, "I think I'm hungry, I'll have breakfast." And you go down and you look in the refrigerator and you see some eggs and you think, "Maybe I'll make some boiled eggs," or "Maybe I should eat healthy, I'll have some oatmeal." You know, and then you make oatmeal. And then you think, coffee or tea? And then you think, "Oh, it's a little too hot for coffee. I'll make the coffee and then I'll ice it." And then you start thinking about maybe something that you have to do at work. And you begin to get a little tense about that maybe. Or maybe you're excited about a project. Then you go off to work, and you're doing your job, and you're thinking about something at home, and then something happens like this. You know, your boss calls you in, and he says, "We're going to have to make a big change in the schedule. I said you could get that in a month, but I'm going to have it in 2 weeks. So you're going to have to do a lot of overtime." And you think to yourself, "Oh, wait a minute, I've made this promise to my partner at home. I can't do the overtime now." But then you look at your boss's face and you realize you have to do this, right? Maybe you even fear him a little bit or her a little bit. And then all the way home, you're driving home thinking, "Oh God, you're going to have a big argument. And then you get home and your partner doesn't understand and maybe feels neglected. And then you go to bed at night and you're thinking, oh, you know, what'll I do? You know, either my partner's going to be mad at me or my boss is going to be mad at me. And when you get up the next day, you're maybe not as free and easy as you were the previous day. Right? And maybe when your partner comes downstairs, you're a little bit anxious. Maybe you even have an argument. You know, that would be the perfect way to start the day. Right? So you have an argument with your partner, and then you go off to work, and you're mad, and you're guilty, right? And you get to work, and you see your boss, and you just think, I'd like to punch him right in the face. Then you feel guilty because sometimes your boss has been good to you. And then you start to worry because you don't know if this report will be any good. And then you start to think, you know, that you're no good, right? And these days go on and on like this. And finally, the report gets turned in, and maybe the boss says, good job. And maybe the boss doesn't say anything. And you sit in your desk and you think, I put in all that work and I didn't get a thanks. Then you think, he's really not a very good boss. Or you think, maybe I didn't do a good job. Maybe he doesn't have a high opinion of me. So all day long you worry about whether your boss thinks you're not that good. When you drive home, your wife or your partner is talking to you, but you can't focus because you're still worried about your boss's opinion. You lie down at night thinking you're going to go to sleep, but you can't sleep because you're worried you might lose your job. You think about your future, your house payments, and so on and so on. I think this is a little bit like life, isn't it? Of course, there are good moments, too. You know, maybe you go to work the next day, and your wife comes downstairs or your husband comes downstairs and says, you know, I really think you're doing a good job. And you have a very positive feeling, you know. You get in your car, you drive to work, and the boss says, by the way, you know, well done on that report. Yeah, be a nice day, wouldn't it? That would be nice. And you have, by the way, you have a raise. You know? You think, oh, this is great. You sit down at your desk and you think, you know, everything is perfect right now, but it can't last, can it? Then you start worrying. That's like ordinary consciousness. This is like the human world, right? And we could get more complicated with it, right? Maybe your partner didn't come home, didn't get up in the morning and say, oh, honey, you're doing a good job. Maybe your partner gave you a sour look, like you're a bad person, you're neglecting our marriage, and you're thinking, that's unfair because I have to work late, okay? So you go to work, and you're working late, and you're thinking, you know, my partner and I have been having a lot of arguments lately. And then somebody comes in from the office complex next door and gives you a strange look, maybe a seductive look, right? And you think, you know, I'm pretty lonely. Right? So I think I'll go to dinner with this person. And then, you know, maybe things escalate, and you have an affair. And then you start to think, gee, you know, I think I've made a terrible mistake. I love my family. Why did I do this? So then you're back at home and you're lying in bed, and now you're not just thinking about getting fired, you're thinking about your partner discovering your infidelity, you know? And you go to work the next day and you feel just terrible. You don't know which way to turn, right? I mean, this is like the human, we can go through all the variations on all of this, right? Maybe the company has to downsize. And even though you did a good report, the boss calls you in and says, listen, I'm going to have to let you go. We've got to cut 20 employees and you're the junior person, you know. And then you go home thinking, I'm a loser, I'm nobody, I'm a failure, et cetera, et cetera. And then you think about your Uncle Louie, who was unemployed most of his life, and your father used to say, Uncle Louie is a bum, and you're thinking, my God, I'm a bum. What would Dad say about me? You know, and so on. So this is like ordinary consciousness, and there's nothing wrong with it. You know, it's the way we all live to a certain degree. You know, And if you read novels and you watch television, you see stories that dramatize the adventures of the self in the world, you know. And in our culture, you know, we have a democratic culture and a consumer culture. So we believe that self is very important, like politically, right? You know, everybody should be treated with respect. And that's a good idea, right? Everybody gets a vote. Every self gets a vote. And we have a consumer society. So we say, you know, basically, what would your self like today? You know, if you like hot chocolate, we've got hot chocolate for you. You know, if you like mint in your chocolate, we have mint in the chocolate. You know? So we hope your self is happy today, right? So this is like the ordinary human life. And the ordinary human adventure, and it has many stresses and strains, and it has many rewards. Right? I mean, when your spouse comes downstairs, or your partner comes downstairs and says, "Honey, I really think you're a great guy or a great gal," you know, you feel wonderful. And when your boss comes in and says, "Well done," you know, you feel a warm glow of satisfaction. You know? When your boss comes in and says, "I'm afraid we're going to have to lay you off," you know, you feel like you're plunged into hell, right? And when your spouse is not talking to you, you feel angry, isolated, abandoned, etc., etc. Yeah. All of this is quite familiar. And of course, things can go wrong in all kinds of ways. You know, you can be so unhappy with yourself that you begin to look for escapes, right? You know, maybe you start drinking. You know, you come home every night and you feel bad about yourself. And then you say, well, maybe a drink would help. And you have a drink and you feel a little better. You feel a little bit less bad about yourself, and you feel a little more open, a little more happy, you know, and a little less crippled by your self-consciousness, you know? And then you start doing this every night. You come home and you think, that was nice, you know. But pretty soon you have a different kind of a problem, right, you know. So people can carry things around with them for a long time. So, you know, maybe you don't get laid off from your job, but maybe your boss doesn't give you a good report. It's not the report you were hoping for. You lie down at night and you start thinking about Uncle Louie, the guy who couldn't hold down a job, you know. You begin to worry that you yourself are like Uncle Louie, right? And things that your father or mother may have said to you begin to haunt you, you know. And you suddenly find that the joy has gone out of your work. You're so afraid of making a mistake, you're so afraid of winding up like Uncle Louie, that there's like a constant undercurrent of nervousness or fear. This is like another aspect of the adventure of the adventure of the self, right? And for all of this, I think, is quite common, you know. The Dalai Lama has said on many occasions that humans are pretty much all the same. And I think this is quite true. I think the little stories I've told could have been told about humans anywhere in the world, you know. I mean, basically, we could be talking about people in Cairo, or people in New York City, or people in India. I mean, some of the details would be different, but pretty much it would be the same thing, you know. I mean, if you were in New York City, you might see somebody get into you know, a BMW at the end of the workday, and you might be getting into your Honda, and you might think, you might begin to worry that he's being paid a lot more than you, and you might feel angry or slighted, or you might feel inferior, you know. And if you were in Saudi Arabia, you know, the guy might have 5 camels, and you might have 1 camel. Not that anybody really has camels anymore, but it would be different, right? And you'd think, oh my God, he's got 5 camels. What a loser I am. You know, I'm just like Uncle Abdul. You know? Yes. Right. I'm going to wind up like him, a man without a single date tree to his name. Right? So this is a very common human adventure. Now, there are cultural differences, you know, but I think humans work pretty much the same way. So, that's the normal human consciousness. Now, sometimes people, for various reasons, get interested in Zen. You know, they get interested in Zen. And you come to maybe beginning meditation on a Monday night, and you hear my standard speech, and you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath, and at the end of two meditation periods, you might begin to feel a little more calm, a little more happy, without knowing why. You know, it's interesting, right? I mean, you sit down on the cushion and you begin to feel happy, you begin to feel calm, and you don't know why, but it's better, right? So at least that you're relaxed, you know? And so you decide to come back, you know? Sometimes it's rough. People came last night, a couple people, Brian brought a couple of his friends with him, and they were so motivated, especially the guy. He said, oh, cool, you know? I said, hi, my name is Kurt, I'm the teacher, and you're interested in Zen? He said, oh yeah, cool. You know? And I was excited for him. He was very motivated, but you know, he found the posture very difficult. He discovered that it was hard to focus his mind, and I think he actually had to walk around outside during the second sit. So it was harder than he thought. But sometimes people come, and they do this, and they feel better at the end of the evening, and then they come back. And if they keep coming back, eventually, this very strange thing is going to happen. You know, at first, you're watching your breath, and the thoughts are going through your head, and it's like a flurry or torrent of thoughts. You know, you just see this thought, and often they trigger emotions. Like the person who had a hard time last night told me he has many stressors in his life, and that as he sat down on the cushion, it became worse. He said, I became so aware of all these things that I had to get up and walk around. And that's quite common. You know, normally we mask all of that. It's there, but we conceal it from ourselves. So, you know, if you're very stressed from work, you come home and you flip on the television. And you watch television, and television is kind of often very mindless, right? And you can just watch the pictures on the screen. You're not thinking about your boss anymore. You're not thinking about, you know, what a loser you might be, or so on and so on. And it's refreshing. I remember when I was in college, I went to the house of a friend of mine, and his father was a big lawyer in West Virginia. He had quite a, actually, I guess, a very famous law firm. And he would come home from work and sit down in the, while he was waiting for dinner, he would watch the Lucy show on television. And he was like this hugely high-priced, top-drawer lawyer, and he'd just come home and watch the Lucy show. And, you know, they'd be making, Ethel and Lucy would be making pies, or, you know, Lucy would be pulling some trick on Ricky, and it would backfire, and the plots are incredibly conventional, right? They're very well done, but it's like, and he would be laughing, you know. I just thought, that's amazing, you know, why is he watching? But it was the pure, you know, it was almost the Three Stooges, you know. It was like the pure stupidity of it all was relaxing, you know. So, we develop these strategies for dealing with the tension, but it's under there. It's like the mind has many layers, you know, and right under the surface, there's this layer that's replaying the argument with the boss or something. It's right under the surface. And this is what this guy last night discovered. He sat down on the cushion thinking, oh boy, you know, bliss. And instead, he confronted all of these things that were causing him stress, and he couldn't get deeper. But eventually, if you keep practicing, your mind will go through that layer, and you'll get down to this layer of the mind where there's absolutely nothing there. It's just absolutely blank and empty. And our word for this is mushin, mushin. If you do a lot of meditation, you'll eventually get to that place. And it's quite a lovely place. At first, it might be a little alarming to encounter mushin, but it's really quite extraordinary. Now, you know, the ordinary view of the world is that it's the world we experience when we're in our individual selves. You know, so I get up and I think, what'll it be, oatmeal or boiled eggs? You know, and a hot coffee or iced coffee, you know? That's the world of ordinary consciousness. And generally speaking, that's the world our culture thinks of as the real world, right? But actually, that's just an image of the world that we've created. That's just the image of the world that you get at that level of the mind. Right? So, you know, basically, if you were a monkey, the world would look very different to you. It's really not the case, in my opinion, that a monkey sees the world the same way we do. It's not like we see the world accurately and the monkey sees the world with these screwed up monkey eyes, see. Humans see the world through human eyes. And so we tend to notice certain things and ignore certain things. And even our, you know, a monkey might see something that we see as green, they might see it as blue, who knows, you know. But the point is, we pretty much have created, there is a real world, but what we know of it is pretty much what we're interested in. You know? You know, if we look at a neighborhood, we would say there's a bunch of houses there. If you were a bird, you would say, oh, there's a bunch of trees and something in between them. But who cares about that? In other words, you know, birds don't care about houses, they care about trees. So the top layer of the mind organizes experience in a certain way. It organizes reality in a certain way. And it organizes it around the little character we call the self. Okay? The next layer of the mind is more complex, right? Because it's where all these emotions reside and all of these memories are in play. So, you know, when we're in that layer of the mind, we're often much more volatile, right? It's like, whoa, up and down and up, you know. So one minute you're thinking, damn, you know, I'm the king of the world and I've got it knocked, you know. The next minute you're thinking, oh, what a loser. Oh my God, I'm going to lose my job, you know, that sort of thing. So there's like this these emotions which are not very usually like very mature, you know, right under the surface, and then there's these memories and so much less, or sort of we would say rational, right under the surface. So it's like the top of the mind is like an ordinary human being, and right under that level is like a madman, really, you know, kind of. The madman's hidden under the facade of normality, you know. And then under that, if you keep going down, there's this layer where there's absolutely nothing. Now, you know, there are many people who would say that what we're doing when we sit on the cushion and enter mushin is wasting our time. They would say, what are you doing all that for, you know? And that's really a reflection of a certain kind of culture, right? In places like ancient China or India or Tibet, people understood that the world is more complex than we can appreciate through the top layer of our mind. And basically, the world we see through this sort of through the top layer of our mind is not the real world. It's just a certain kind of, it's a very selective picture of the real world. And so, you know, if you go down deeper, you reach this emptiness. And in Buddhist cultures, and also to some degree in Hindu cultures, this emptiness is quite well understood as part of reality, either the reality of the mind or the reality of the world. And so the idea is you can't really get a full picture of everything if you're just talking about the world through like one layer of the mind. You know, you need to get a like a fuller picture by sort of including all of the layers. You know, how does the world look from this layer? How does the world look from this layer? I hope I'm making some sense. Anyway. This layer of the mind, which is empty, it is quite important in Zen. And when you're in that state of mind, and you look at the world, it's a very different place, or can be a very different place. So today we went outside and we walked, and many of us have been sitting here doing meditation from 7 a.m. So some of us had done 5 periods of meditation, some of us had done 2, and we walked outside and we did that beautiful walk around the fountain. And I don't know about you, but it was really a great experience for me. I didn't really want to stop, you know. Those trees around the fountain are linden trees. And they are a beautiful tree, I think. And we were walking under the lindens, and we were doing a circle. And, you know, you could feel the warm cement underfoot, the cool breezes on your face. And I have to say that, you know, as I was walking, there was very, very few thoughts in my mind. You know, my mind was just sort of like blank. And all of this stuff was registering very richly and beautifully, you know. And there was a kind of natural unfolding to things. And this is really quite, I think, a wonderful state. You know, even if you are very distressed, you know, it's a big illusion to think that... if you eventually have Daikensho, there will be no further difficulties in your life. As long as we're learning something new, as long as we're encountering the world, there are going to be occasions where we have, where we're surprised or thrown off balance or knocked back on our asses, you know. Life can't really be understood until we bump into it and go, huh? You know, living is impossible unless you have moments where you are knocked on your butt. That's how we encounter reality. You know, we form an image of the world, and we can refine that image quite a bit, but sooner or later, something is going to knock us on our butt. It's like you bump your head into an invisible wall, right? And you go, huh? And then you begin to realize, wait a minute, I think I can see this wall, you know. It takes a little time. Well, that's inevitably part of life, no matter how many years you've meditated. I think that people who do meditation have like tools at their disposal for coping with those kinds of events, you know, sort of setbacks or moments when we're off balance or when we're unhappy. You know, if you're learning something new, you may find if you have a certain kind of, there's some people who are able to deal with setbacks and obstacles without becoming too unhappy about it. You know, they just move along. And those people are lucky. Some people have to work harder, you know, because when they have setbacks, their ego structure is not very strong or flexible, and they begin to have these corrosive doubts and maybe self-loathing and so on and so on. No matter which way you might happen to be, When you have these setbacks, if you do Zen, you have this tremendous resource. Because normally, when we have those setbacks, we're trapped in that top layer of the mind. You know, the mind that you know, picks coffee or iced coffee or hot coffee, that lies in bed at night and thinks, am I going to be like Uncle Louie, and so on and so on. That's like the toolkit of the ordinary mind is rather limited, you know. We Zen people have like a bigger toolkit, you know. So when we're, you know, we're in distress, or we're unhappy, or we're facing an obstacle we can't seem to get through, you know, what we can do is sit on the cushion and go down through the layers of the mind until we get to this place which is empty. And this is so healing and so powerful. And by the way, it's not less yourself, it's not less part of you, I should say, than the part that says, oh boy, I like iced coffee, or I'd like a raise, or the, you know what I mean? We identify so heavily with the top layer of the mind, with the part of ourselves that is the self, right? The part of ourselves that's the self. We identify that with that so totally that we don't appreciate who we really are. You know, if you go down through the layers of the mind, you know, you encounter, there's the self, then there's like the madman, right? Under that, there's like, memories from childhood, and then there's like the realm of the gods, you know? There are these images and these forces, psychological forces that are very powerful, you know? The god of love, the god of war, all of them are in there, you know, down there, and so on. And you go a little deeper, and then there's the emptiness, right? And then under that is enlightened mind, you know. So the point is, we have this wonderful resource, this toolkit, you know. We can go down, down, down into the mind, and we can enter mushin, enter shunyata. And when we look at the world through the eyes of shunyata, it's very different than when we look at the world through the eyes of the self. Because, you know, the self is always nervously trying to adjust things, you know, picking and choosing, yes and no, right and wrong. But when we get to the layer of this, of ourselves, that is this emptiness, you know, when we look at the world, it's with this kind of serene, serenity, right? Serene openness. You know, we're walking around that circle this morning. It was like serene openness. You know, it's like whatever happens is okay. You know, if you're really deeply in mushin, you know, even if people are walking by or somebody's playing a tuba or something like that, it doesn't matter. It's like, it doesn't really matter. And this is like tremendously helpful, because when we can access this level of ourselves, you know, we're able to deal better with that, you know, the problems that the little self faces in everyday life. We realize that's not all there is to me. That's not all there is to life. You know, life is actually much richer than that, much bigger than that. And I don't have to be so trapped in myself. You know, normally people don't really feel a strong desire to get outside of themselves. You know, they're pretty happy being a self. But sometimes when we encounter setbacks or painful events, you know, we realize the inadequacy of the self as a, you know, a tool for dealing with life. And then people can become, say, religious. You know, they become prayers and so on, and that's very important. But we Zen people are a little different. We certainly respect people's prayers, and, you know, we, as we go down through the mind and we see the great gods, we nod, you know, hello, how do you do? You know. But we go down to this level of shunyata, and when we look at the world, it's as though it's the first day of creation. Everything is fresh and new. And this can be tremendously helpful. Even if we feel totally trapped on the level of the small self, having this contact with this expansive, non-judgmental, all-embracing awareness is tremendously liberating. And so, you know, Zen practice is a bit like a stereoscopic mind, you know. You've got the little self and the big self, let's say, you know. And you're using the big self to help liberate the little self. And you're using the little self to help develop the big, you know, help to feed the big self, you could say. You know, so this is like a normal Zen mind, right? It's like you've got these two different forms of awareness sort of in, you could say, like in dialogue with each other, right? Sometimes they match up. And when they match up, it's really cool. It's really wonderful. I won't say who, but somebody in our group is training to be a lawyer. He's going to law school. I won't mention who, and I'm sure you won't be able to guess. But this person, I don't think this person would mind my saying that he or she was asked to present like at a mock trial. And this person presented at the trial, and it was like magic, right? Just like all of a sudden, this wonderful energy arose, and this person presented, and everybody said, "Holy smokes! Wow, that was great!" And of course, this person said, "Well, how did I do that?" I mean, this happens to people sometimes, right? Where I remember when I was in intermediate school. I wasn't really a very good student. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't anything. I was just unhappy, right? I was an unhappy adolescent. And the principal of the school was a very nice man, and he thought, there must be something we can do to Kurt, with Kurt, that will help him to develop as a human being. And he put me into the play. He sent me down to the music teacher in our high school. And the music teacher was this wonderful man. As an adult, I realized he was gay. But I never, as a child, it never occurred to me, you know. He was this wonderful gay man who really worked hard making good musicians out of the students in the school. And he put me in this play, and I was very... sort of like this cynical 13-year-old or something, and I went to the rehearsals, at the rehearsals I really got into it, and when we actually did the play, I just felt like it was magic. You know, I knew my lines, everything worked, and actually people said, "Oh, you did such a fantastic job! You should be an actor." Well, I fortunately didn't take that advice. But the thing is, you know, it was impressive to me because I was in the Tao, you know. It was like the big mind and the small mind were working in harmony, you know. And there was this tremendous energy to what I was doing, and I didn't know why, but there it was, you know. And this often happens, you know, the little mind doesn't, you know, sometimes we're doing things we don't really want to do. Sometimes we have to do things, right? And sometimes we're doing things because we think we have to. And sometimes we're doing things we don't want to do. And this is just the human fate, right? But sometimes we're doing something that really speaks to us. It's like we say in Zen, the big mind speaks. And it's like suddenly you go before the judge and there's the jury, and all of a sudden you have wings on your feet and you're eloquent. You don't stammer, you don't reach for words, everything's right there. It's a glorious moment, right? And it could have other forms too. You know, you could be a musician, you know, you practice, you practice, you practice. One night you come in, you play this, and it's just impeccable. Right? It's like the big mind and the small mind line up. And when that happens, it's like being a different kind of creature, right? The Garuda can, you know, is like this special bird that can fly down to earth from the realm of the gods and back, you know? So the Garuda is, you know, not much of a symbol in Zen, but in Tibetan Buddhism, the Garuda is very important. You know, Garuda is like that part of yourself that can go through all these different layers of the mind. It can go from heaven to hell. It can go from the world of form to the world of the formless. You know? And when the form, world of form, and the world of formless become one, you know, there's this tremendous energy and this tremendous joy. Now, you know, Zen is a struggle because we have our obstacles, right? You know, sometimes, you know, we don't tap into the big mind because we're afraid, you know, so we have fears. Growing up, we develop karma, you know. You know, maybe you went out for the basketball team and you fell on your face. You know, you did a terrible job, and after that, you're always a little nervous about volunteering, you know. So you're at work and there's a project you want to be involved in, but you're afraid because it'll be just like back in junior high where they threw you off the basketball team. So you don't volunteer and you don't do the project you really want to do, right? That's so typical. That's karma. So a lot of sitting is working through that karma, trying to connect with our big mind. And, you know, we can have events that have scarred us for a long time. So, you know, we have to do a lot of sitting before we can open the door into big mind, you know. But when we do, there's this tremendous energy, this tremendous joy. So, I can't tell you how many times I've come in to sit on a Saturday morning, not just here, but back in Seattle. You know, in Seattle, I was in graduate school, and I was really in a competitive situation where I felt inadequate, you know. I remember being in a graduate class with people who were pretty, you know, people who knew German and French very fluently, people who had read widely in Europe. You know, a lot of the graduate students I competed with came from places like Harvard and Yale, and not only were they very well educated, but they were well, a lot of them were wealthy, you know. When I got to graduate school at the University of Washington, I used to get my groceries with my backpack. You know, I'd go to the grocery store, put my groceries in the backpack, and walk back to my... You know, I had friends in graduate school who had, like, nice cars, and so I felt very overwhelmed by their abilities, you know. And I would go to the Zen Center, and I would sit, and I would start the sit just, like, feeling so down, you know, and so inferior, you know. And then I would sit and sit and sit and sit, and, you know, by the end of the sit, I would feel like a Garuda, you know, like I could just, you know, I would be in that beautiful, empty mind, and I would find courage and joy, and I could, you know, get off my ass and face it, you know. And it didn't always work. Some days my doubts and my karma would be a little too hard to work through. And then I would notice that when I got off the cushion, I wasn't, I might be a little sad still, or I might be grumpy, you know. But you just keep sitting, you know, and sooner or later you work through those karmic obstacles and you connect with your big mind, and then there's this beautiful spontaneous action, which is not really directed towards any particular result. It's just like the unfolding of the universe. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Jingyang's Garuda. A monk asked Jingyang Pu, a dragon king comes out of the sea. Sky and earth are tranquil. How is direct presentation? The master said, the Garuda, king of birds, takes command of the universe. Who can stick his head out here? The monk said, suppose one suddenly appears, what then? Jingyang said, it's like a falcon catching a pigeon. If you don't realize, check in front of the tower. Then for the first time, you'll know the real. This is all rather complicated, but when you're really, when all the layers of your mind are working together, you have a much fuller picture of reality, yeah? Much fuller life. So the monk said, if so, I'll fold my hands on my chest and retreat 3 paces. Jingyang said, you blind turtle under the seat of Mount Sumeru. Don't wait for another scarring from a rap on the head. You know, normally, we second guess ourselves. The in Zen, we say that you know, a divided mind is in a way the situation you want to try to overcome. The divided mind is the problem. In its simplest form, divided mind is like this. I'm sitting on the cushion and I wish I were someone else. Or I'm sitting at my office and I'm dreaming of Hawaii. Or I'm sitting in the kitchen with my partner and I'm dreaming of somebody at work. See? This is a divided mind. And this is like unhealthy. This is an unhealthy mind. A healthy mind isn't divided because your body and your mind are together in the moment. And a healthy mind is united in another way too. It's like small mind and big mind are together and they're lined up. This takes a lot of work, but when it happens, it's really great. Yeah? So when small mind and big mind are together, when body and mind are unified, there's a kind of spontaneity to things. You're not second guessing. You're not looking at yourself with a judgmental view. You're in the flow. This is precious, really wonderful. Right? So Jingyang said, "You blind turtle under the seat of Mount Sumeru." Yeah. Don't wait for another scarring from it. Don't let maybe hit you on the head. You know, be spontaneous. The imperial decree comes down, the commanding orders distinct. Within the heartland, the emperor, outside the borders, the general. Without awaiting the thunder to rouse the insects, how could one know the wind stops the coursing clouds? A continuous weave under the loom. Naturally, there's a gold needle and a jade thread. Before the seal is wide open, emptiness. Originally, there's no writing. See, that's the whole thing. That's the mind from top to bottom. You know, top to bottom. When you speak in words, it's the voice of no words. You know, when you act, it's the voice of no action. Okay? So that's an integrated mind. That's like the Garuda, right, who can fly from heaven to earth. So let's be Garudas, okay?